On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we discuss the disappointing news that Gerrit Cole needs Tommy John surgery and will not be pitching in 2025. And then we preview the NL Central, the Pirates, the Cardinals, the Reds, the Cubs, the Brewers, in what order. You're going to find out on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world for whom it is Central Time in the Eastern Time Zone. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. You like that one?
I do like that one. It's especially timely because as an Ohio resident, it is quite often that the coastal elites think I live in the Central Time Zone. This happens to me quite often. In fact, it just I'm not going to name who it was, but there was someone who sent me a birthday text after Eastern time midnight, assuming, and then explained it as being like, no, it was Central time. I'm like, well, guess what? I don't live in Central time. So I'm not going to say who it was. I'll tell you who it was when we're done recording. But anyway, this is Central time zone in this podcast because we are going to preview the National League Central. So you've come to the right place if you're excited to hear us talk about IKF, the starting shortstop of the Pittsburgh Pirates. But before we preview the NL Central, just as we previewed the NL East, same format, we'll go projected worst to first. We have some large news that, you know, there's a level of news that we would have just saved for next week when we talked about the New York Yankees and the AL East preview. But this Gerrit Cole news is different than the Gerrit Cole news we got exactly a year ago. And that is that Gerrit Cole, I think, has already had Tommy John or is about to. I think it's already already in the past. And so he will not be pitching in 2025. Jake, I know you already wrote about this. You were at Yankees camp. Kind of how this information got disseminated timing wise was a little bit goofy, but It's out there. It was kind of, we were all bracing for it for several days, and now it is true where this guy who's been one of the best and most durable pitchers over the last decade will not be pitching at all in 2025.
Three things on this planet are undefeated: Father Time, Mother Nature, and Uncle Tommy John. It comes for all of us at one point or another. And Gerrit Cole, who had dodged the elbow ligament capitulation for quite a while, it was about time. You're right, the dissemination of this was very bizarre. He made his first spring training start 2 weeks ago and was good and said he felt great. Afterwards, the numbers were good. Then he pitched against the Twins last week. It was a catastrophe. He got obliterated. Then over the weekend, he said, my elbow hurts, got imaging, got a second opinion. As is always the case, the second opinion is usually the same as the first opinion. And it was announced on Monday that Gerrit Cole needed reconstructive elbow surgery. Good old Tommy John. He will be out for the entire year. Now, I think it's worth just noting how incredible it is that he has not needed it yet. Players who throw as hard as Gerrit Cole does for as long as he was throwing that hard, They get this. It is a part of doing business. That is kind of how players think about it. It is unfortunate. It is somewhat dystopic to say, hey, if you want to be a big league pitcher, like, we're going to have to cut into your arm at some point. But that is the fact. And it is not exactly surprising that Gerrit Cole needed Tommy John surgery, considering that a year ago, he was having elbow discomfort. He rested it. He recovered from it. He pitched well and looked like Gerrit Cole down the stretch. But these things build up over time, right? It is not as simple as like, it's torn and you can't pitch and you're fully healthy. This is not a binary, right? There's kind of a spectrum of where the elbow is at. And it was kind of clear given where he was at last year that this was probably coming down the road at some point.
Yeah. And sometimes, right, sometimes, unfortunately, we do see guys like literally blow out and it's like, I can't. Like, you are immediately done pitching. Sometimes it seems to be what happened with Cole, where he was still throwing hard against the Twins as bad as he looked, right? It's not like sometimes it happens and then, oh my God, he's throwing 88 miles an hour and it's over. Sometimes it's in the recovery. It's in how you feel the next day. There's a lot, as you mentioned, there's a lot of different ways that this can kind of reveal itself. And unfortunately for him, this is, I mean, it's just so brutal. And you mentioned, I just think back to the fact that we've had these same feelings and conversations and fears a year ago, and that he managed to avoid it, come back, pitch as well as he did. It wasn't perfect. You know, he had a 3-4 in the regular season. I know a lot of people think about how his season ended in the World Series with that catastrophic fifth inning. Well, let's also remember how he was pitching in the four innings before then. You know, like he was amazing. Like that was Gerrit Cole. That's why you give him, you know, this amazing contract and you have him on your team so that he can pitch like that in the World Series in a must-win game. And yes, of course, by the end, no one remembers that part because of everything that happened in the fifth. But Gerrit Cole, the pitcher, somehow had managed to avoid this, had rested and rehabbed it to the point where he could contribute to a team that went to the World Series. And now he will not be able to do that for a Yankees team that is obviously still very focused on getting back to and winning a World Series.
Gerrit Cole getting hurt, like his Instagram post was the first time in a long time where I like felt actively bad for the Yankees, which was a very difficult thing. Do you know what I mean? Like that's just not a feeling that people around baseball often have, but just the idea that like he's here to win this ring for this team and the window is now dwindling where he has 3 more years to accomplish this once he gets back, and the idea that the Judge Cole era very well could end without a championship for the Yankees is really significant. I mean, if you're a hater, it's funny. If you're a lover, it's a bummer. And if you're us, you're just enthralled by that.
Yeah. I think too, you know, you think, okay, and you mentioned the post. Of course, every guy that has Tommy John, sorry, I'll come back stronger than ever. And maybe that's true, right? We saw Justin Verlander come back at age 39 after Tommy John and win a Cy Young. Like he, and when we're talking about pitchers at this level, it would not surprise me if Gerrit Cole comes back and is awesome again. But we'll be talking about his, you know, he'll be basically, he's turning 35 this September, so he'll be turning 36 next September, which hopefully by September 2026, he is back on the mound. But full Tommy John is with this timing. This is also important when we talk about the timing. It's different for everybody, but we've talked recently about the difference between full Tommy John, which is the full reconstruction versus the internal brace surgery, which guys like Lucas Giolito and Spencer Strider got early last season. And those guys are already expected to come back in the early part of this year. Whereas Shane Bieber, who had Tommy John in April of last year, full Tommy John, like he's not expected back until July. So I'm not expecting Gerrit Cole to be pitching for the Yankees before close to, you know, the All-Star break of 2026. But the point is for this year, right now, we can save the how are they going to replace him for the AL East preview. We'll talk about the Yankees. We can save that conversation for later. But is there anything else for Cole specifically in his career that you kind of want to get at as we can? Because this is the other thing. We talk about field. Like we just adore Gerrit Cole. Like he is... has been one of my favorite Yankees since he's been there. He's extremely honest, extremely insightful. Just a different thinker. He's one of the guys whose post-game interviews are genuinely compelling because of the way that he thinks about the game and the degree to which he is willing to talk about it. And so that just sucks. And I know that the way I'm sure he will still be valuable to the Yankees in some ways. I know Clark Schmidt had a quote being like, great, we just have another pitching coach now for 2025, because it's not like Gerrit Cole. I mean, I'm sure he will be away for some, he's going to have to be away to for some degree. I wouldn't expect him to like be on the road all the time in the early stages of this rehab, but he'll be around and he'll still be in some sort of presence. But, you know, if the Yankees get back to the postseason again, no matter who's on that team, we're going to be thinking like, man, there's no Gerrit Cole, and that's going to be a really... And we were already thinking that when this first happened a year ago, but obviously by the time we got to October, we didn't have to worry about it. Now we will. They will not have him this postseason if they get there.
Baseball's more interesting when Gerrit Cole is in it. It's that simple to me, right? Yep. I am bummed for him and for the team and for all of us who like thinking about him and like watching him pitch. Also fascinating is, like, if he never throws another pitch, is this a Hall of Famer? Like, he will throw another pitch, almost certainly. But just thinking about his resume and his legacy, is so much of that is, like, tied up in durability that he's gotten to, I think, 150 wins. He will never get to 300, which is impossible now. But, you know, if he totally could get to 200 or even 215, like, thinking about Gerrit Kohl's legacy now, as we're about to be without him for a year and a half, I'm very interested in kind of how we look back.
I mean, this is a guy who did finally get that Cy Young in 2023 after he probably deserved it in 2019, finished second in 2021, finished top five three other years. Like,
he's
going to have a pretty good case among the modern pitchers where we're not as concerned about the counting stats. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what he's able to add to at that point. And the Yankees now, we'll talk about how they replace him, but what is also relevant, I don't want to dig too much into the contract stuff, but yeah, I mean, he's still making $36 million for the next four seasons. And that is a lot of money to be paying someone that's not playing. They obviously have a few of those guys right now, which is part of the Yankees' issues. And as Brian Cashman already said, like, we're probably not going external because of the luxury tax implications. Well, that's why you run into some issues if you're paying $50 million plus dollars to players that are not playing right now. That is a challenge for the Yankees right now. Again, no one feels bad for them, obviously, but that is certainly an interesting issue for the Yankees. But that is a discussion for the AL East preview. Any final thoughts on Gerrit Kohl before we get to his former team, the Pittsburgh Pirates?
Let's do it.
All right. It's time to preview the National League Central. Again, we are going projected worst to first according to FanGraphs. Now, we agree with some of these orders, some of them not, but in this division in particular, it's pretty jumbled together. So you could make an argument that we should be going in a lot of different orders, but I think we will fairly begin with the team that finished in last place. Once again, one of the worst teams in baseball over the last half decade. It is the Pittsburgh Pirates. Jake, why don't you start us off? How did they do last year, and then what did they do to maybe get better in 2025?
Their 2024 over-under was 74.5. We both took the over, and we were right. 76 wins, still in last place. That was the second consecutive year that they finished with 76 wins, which is a good reminder that even though the Pirates are bad, they haven't been awful the last 2 years. They've just been regular bad. What did they do? Now, okay, we should also say, very notable part of their 2024 season, was Paul Skenes showed up and was immediately a sensation. His starts were must-see TV, and he finished the year, I believe, with an ERA under 2 and won the NL Rookie of the Year in one of the greatest debut seasons in the history of the sport. And with that cornerstone in place, what did the Pirates do over the winter? Not much, really. No.
They didn't spend a whole bunch of money like we've been hoping that they would at least start to do. They traded Luis Ortiz, one of their starting pitchers, for Spencer Horwitz, who was immediately injured and has not yet played yet. That was kind of their big acquisition offensively. They bring back Andrew McCutchen. Of course they do. They also bring back Adam Frazier for some reason. They bring in Tommy Pham. They sign Andrew Heaney, Caleb Ferguson, and Tim Mesa, a trio of veteran lefties who will help this pitching staff that maybe didn't need their help, but we can talk about that in a second. But yes, the Pirates, again, to your point, 76 wins each of the last 2 years. They have not been that bad, but they've finished fourth or fifth in 8 straight seasons. They have the longest active postseason drought in the National League, second longest in Major League Baseball behind the Angels. So it has been a while since the Buccos have been competitive. Is this the year they finally break through? Who is on this baseball team behind the dish? Joey Bart. Joey Bart, what? What's Joey Bart doing here? Well, he showed up in Pittsburgh last year and was like kind of pretty good. Andy Rodriguez is coming back from injury. He will probably be the backup, former number one overall pick, Henry Davis. Maybe he will beat him out. Maybe.
I think Henry will be the backup to start because Andy missed all of last season with TJ. And
okay,
I would predict he's in AAA to start the season. At first base, the aforementioned Spencer Horwitz, but I think they're going to start DJ Stewart over there.
I mean, Horwitz hasn't played yet, so he's not going to be ready anytime soon, but it will be him, hopefully, at some point.
I watched DJ Stewart acquire a first baseman's glove for use from a Rawlings representative in the clubhouse yesterday. So I was like, hey, he is going to play some first base.
That's good. I'm glad that's your opening day first baseman. Really inspiring.
Nick Gonzalez at second, Cabrian Hayes at third, Isaiah Kiner-Falefa at shortstop, the always intense Tommy Pham in left, O'Neill Cruz moving to center field for the Pirates, Brian Reynolds in right, Andrew McCutchen forever at DH. He's actually pretty good. Like,
it's fine.
It's a career achievement award that he has tenure with the Pirates. He can be there as long as he'd like, but he's not. There's a world in which it's a problem bringing Andrew McCutchen back every year, but he has legitimately been a real contributor for them. The starting rotation is Paul Skeens, Mitch Keller, Jared Jones, Andrew Heaney, and Bailey Falter. That is a very strong group, and there is a squadron of pitching prospects in the upper minors ready to add to it with Bubba Chandler and Thomas Harrington. Am I missing anybody else?
Yeah, I mean, Braxton Ashcraft, Michael Burrows, like Chandler is the big one that I think will could make a Jared Jones type impact very soon. But there, yeah, there are guys there if and when Bailey falters. Who's in the bullpen?
Bullpen, David Bednar, Dennis Santana, Colin Holderman. One big question about this team. It's the same as last year. Who's hitting? This franchise has been pretty good at developing arms over the last few seasons. Homegrown arms. They have not been able to do that on the offensive side of the ball. So, like, who touches home plate here?
Yeah, I mean, this was a bottom, you know, bottom 10, bottom 5 offense by some metrics. And, I mean, ceiling-wise, that's the other thing is, like, the only one we see having a superstar ceiling is O'Neill Cruz, and he's shown flashes of that for sure. Now he's in center field. Brian Reynolds remains very good. Like, he is still a very, very good hitter. He was very good again last year. But this offense and their acquisition, they're you know, remember, they bring in Brian De La Cruz as one of the most embarrassing trade deadline acquisitions. He was literally the worst hitter in baseball after they traded for him. They've just had a lot of hitters that they brought in who have been bad, or their young guys like Brian Hayes, whether it's due to injury or not, have not taken the step forward that we've wanted. Nick Gonzalez seems like a solid contributor. You kind of know what you're getting from him. But yeah, how are they going to score? We asked the same question a year ago, but as the pitching continues to look even better, this is going to become even more frustrating because, again, I hear it with the Mariners. I've heard it for the last 3 years. You say, okay, great. You've amassed this amazing pitching staff. The envy of the league to have all of this young, controllable pitching, this cheap, all these guys are on there. I know, you know, Keller's on an extension, but Skeens on the minimum, Jared Jones on the minimum. You're going to have Chandler and Harrington and all these guys. Like, this is what teams are dying to have. And if you can't score, it doesn't matter. Now, I think what's interesting as we move to the key players here is that the bullpen was also terrible last year. And that was sometimes a problem where you did get these good starts. And Bednar, who had been awesome, I'll talk about him in a second, and Chapman and some of these other younger guys, it was you didn't even have that to support the starting pitching. So they have this core competency, it seems, around Skeens, who might be the best pitcher on earth. But it just does not look like a good team around it right now. And as long as they're willing or unwilling to spend anywhere close to what almost any other team in baseball is willing to spend, as this is still a bottom five payroll, they are going to be in it, making it harder for themselves to really compete.
Let me do key player and I'll get micro and then I'll get macro and crush the ownership group. O'Neill Cruz is the most important player on this team this year because he is the one with an MVP level ceiling. He is also now moving positions. The Pirates internally think he has a chance to be special out in center field. He only needs to take like 4 steps to catch any fly ball because he's 7 feet tall. I don't want to say I gave up on O'Neill Cruz at the middle of last year, but I was growing really skeptical about his ability to be a star just because he struggled so much against left-handed pitching as a left-handed hitter. That got a lot better down the stretch and rekindled a little bit of that hope. But he needs to be a monster for this team to make the playoffs.
Yeah.
They have a lot of interesting players. Like, there's a lot of guys where you can squint and think that could work. They don't have anybody who horrifies you at the dish. And O'Neill Cruz is their best shot at having a guy like that.
Yeah. And they also don't have that guy coming in the minor leagues right now. That's the other thing. The top of their system offensively,
like, all arms.
We love Tomar, but I would love to be wrong, and he might hit his way to the big leagues this year, but it's, again, he's looking more like a complimentary piece than a real game changer. So yeah, O'Neill is so important, and it's worth noting for those that weren't watching the Pirates on the stretch this year, he did play a month in center field last year. So this is not like, you know, opening day will not be his first game in center field, but it is an interesting look. It's obviously interesting seeing a 6'7" guy at shortstop, but seeing a guy that gigantic out in center ranging the way that he can is really interesting. I'm going to go with Bednar for my X factor. listen, you could pick a lot of hitters because the offense is that important. Bednar was one of the best closers in baseball in 2022 and 2023, and he stunk last year. And if this pitching staff, like if Bednar can get back to being one of the best closers in baseball, this could be legitimately one of the best pitching staffs in baseball. And it was just a weird year. It was a weird year for him. He ended up losing the closer job. They haven't even fully committed to him going back to the closer job this year. But there are some other younger arms where they could fill in. And I think it's going to be a better bullpen than it was last year, almost no matter what. But if they can get him back on track to being like an elite ninth inning guy, now we're looking at a truly excellent run prevention group. And so I'm curious to see if he can bounce back because he's also, you know, he's a Pittsburgh guy. He's a fan favorite. And I'm sure he wants to get back on track for a franchise that is maybe has enough talent to be relevant this season. But we'll see. The over under is 76.5. I think you can, if you have one more big picture thought about the ownership, share it now. 76.5. I am still going to take the under slightly. I think this is still a team that ends up stuck right in this same range for the third year in a row. And a lot of it is because of what I think you can kind of finish off with, which is just like there's parts of this organization that have proven to be trending in the right direction. And then there's other parts, certainly at the highest level, but even some of the other development parts that it's just like, I'm not believing. And it's frustrating because when you have some of the talent that they do, you want them to make the most of it. But right now we're still in the stage where they really have to go prove us wrong the way that, you know, teams like Kansas City and Detroit did a year ago. So maybe this is that step forward, but until that happens, it's just really hard for me to expect it.
No ownership group should be more embarrassed. No ownership group has exhibited more cowardice than the one running the Pirates, led by Bob Nutting. And here's why. When Paul Skeens falls into your lap and you do not take advantage of that, it is a generational missed opportunity. As Gerrit Cole's injury reminds us, pitchers are volatile. At any point during his Pirates tenure, Skeens could, unfortunately, miss a year and a half of time. Any moment, any opportunity, any window you have with a potential top three pitcher in the world to win for real, to change the complexion of the franchise, to alter the reputation of this organization in the eyes of the industry, you do not grasp that. You do not put your foot down against the pedal and rev your engine is just unacceptable to me. And that's also because Skeens is a moneymaker for them. Every day he starts at home, the place is packed, they're selling jerseys. Interest in this team is up because of him single-handedly. He is not someone who the Pirates developed. He was not a finished product and they have helped him become what he is right now. But Paul Skeens made Paul Skeens. And the Pirates are reaping the benefits of that. And they are not reinvesting those rewards into the ball club. And fans, in a way, should be madder now than they were before Skeens. Because there's a golden goose, and they're just taking those eggs and hiding them under the bed. They're not using it. It's just a reminder that this is all a money-making operation. It is a cash cow for Bob Nutting. And I feel for the people in this organization who have to wake up every day and work under those circumstances. Now, there's an element of it that I'm sure is galvanizing in the Moneyball A's type way that, hey, we all work here, right? We're all underfunded. We're all undersupported. The resources are not good enough. And that does foster something real. But man, like, this team could have used a bopper. They should have just paid that for Pete Alonso. They should have signed Anthony Santander. There was a path here with this group to contention, and they have completely whiffed at that opportunity. And for that reason, I will take the over on 76 games, 76.5. I think it'll be 77.
Okay. And all right, there you go. Finished with some optimism there.
But yeah, just quickly, one last thing. I sat down yesterday with Paul Skeens for 20 minutes and I'm writing something about him. Like, what a blessing this guy is. What a thing we are able and allowed to witness.
Yeah. Trust me. Having watched it up close in a few different settings last year.
Let me leave it with this. If Paul Skeens is coming to Yo City, buy it. It is worth it.
What's the Anthony Edwards quote? Bring your ass. Yeah. Get over there. Go watch Paul. Skip work if Paul's pitching in your city on a Tuesday afternoon or whatever. It's definitely worth the show. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, talk about the Reds and the Cardinals in what order? We'll be right back on Baseball Barbercast. It is time to talk about the Cincinnati Reds. And Jake, I realized that when we previewed the Pittsburgh Pirates, I did not mention what Fangraphs had as their projected record and their playoff odds. Now, conveniently, at least when I looked at it yesterday, it is literally exactly the same as the Cincinnati Reds. Funnily enough.
Hell yeah.
So I will just confirm that today. Yes. Okay. So basically, Fangraphs has both the Reds and the Pirates at 20% to make the playoffs and 12% to win the division. So honestly, 12% to win the division for most years for the Pirates and the Reds, you're like, all right, awesome. All right, we're riding. But I also do think that the vibe around these teams is different for some different reasons. But let's get into it. Let's talk about the Reds of Cincinnati. As I mentioned, like Pittsburgh projected to win 78 games, 20% chance to make the playoffs. How did they do last year? Well, last year, coming off of a very exciting 2023 season, there was buzz. That seemed like the team. It was like, all right, here we go. I watched it up close. I was mostly sold. I was mostly encouraged even after a weird offseason they had last year. And Matt McClain is out before the season even starts. And then the injuries keep on coming. And it was just not pretty. The line last year was 82.5. They won 77 games. We both took the over and were wrong. Boom. So how did the Reds respond this winter? They were one of the busiest teams of the offseason. That doesn't mean they spent the most money, but they were consistently in the news. It began when Nick Martinez accepted the qualifying offer, to my understanding, much to the surprise of the Cincinnati Reds, as we thought Nick Martinez could go out and get a solid multi-year deal, but instead he decides to stay with the Reds after a very solid season. So he's making $20 million this year. But then they kept going. Obviously, before all of this, they hired Terry Francona. And that is, of course, the most relevant, because all the players involved here are, you know, interesting to us. But to the average baseball fan, it's like, oh, Terry Francona, I know that guy. And now he's in charge of the Reds. That's cool. That's important. That's probably the biggest move that they made. But they did make a lot of other acquisitions. They trade Jonathan India for Brady Singer. They trade for Gavin Lux. They sign Austin Hayes. They trade for Jose Trevino to be their backup catcher. They trade for Taylor Rogers, veteran lefty in the bullpen. They break up the Rogers brothers in San Francisco. How dare they? Now they have a very strange roster where there are a good number of good players, and you're not quite sure how they all fit. So, Jake, who is on the Cincinnati Reds?
There is not a team in baseball that confuses me more. And here we go. Behind the plate, Tyler Stevenson. At first base, Jaimer Candelario, who still has two more years left on his contract. And I went back and listened to our pod last year, and I was like, I do not believe in this guy. He was mid, right?
I'll get to him. I'll get to him for my key player. So we'll get there.
Second base, Matt McClain. Third base, Gavin Lux, I guess. Shortstop, Elly De La Cruz. God, what a delight. Outfield, Austin Hayes, TJ Friedl, and Jake Fraley. DH will be some weird combo of Will Benson, Christian Encarnacion Strand, Spencer Steer when he gets back from injury. The starting rotation, Hunter Green, Brady Singer, Nick Lodolo, Nick Martinez, Andrew Abbott with Rhett Lauder and Chase Burns coming down the pipe. In the bullpen, Edwin Diaz's brother, Tyler or Trevor Rogers, who can say? Angel Pagan, Sam Moll, and Tony Santillan. Jordan.
Angel Pagan. Oh, man. That's someone who was at Mets camp this morning. That's Emilio Pagan. I don't believe Angel Pagan is now pitching in the Reds bullpen.
I know. I know where I am.
nor do I think, although I don't blame you for the Rogers flub, unless you're referencing the lefty of Trevor Rogers or the twin, Tyler Rogers. Anyway.
Jordan, it's not a flub if you mean to do it. One big question of this team. You're an Ohio resident, even though this club is 4 hours away from you. You were around them a lot last year. How big of a deal is the infusion, the arrival of Terry Francona and his championship mentality?
I mean, with respect to David Bell and how that kind of petered out by the end, remember, David Bell got an extension when this team was cooking in the summer of 2023, and it was like, here we go. But it just, it ran its course. And obviously it was time to shake things up. This is as much of a shakeup as you can get. And the fact that they could pull Tito, it's not surprising that Tito wanted to come out and manage again, but this is a pretty exciting combination of things. And I think the reason why this is our big question is because we are the ones that come on here and be like, how important are managers? Like, we don't know how important these guys are. And I think we still maintain that. However, when you're talking about Terry Francona, who is universally regarded as one of the best in the business, and you combine that with a roster that is going to require a lot of literal managing, like, there are so many pieces on this team that are going to be needed to placed in the right sequence, in the right position, in the right part of the batting order, facing the right hitters or facing the right pitchers, facing the right hitters, whether it's in the bullpen, whether it's, you know, this construction of this outfield, this infield around Matt McClain and Ellie De La Cruz, this foundation in the middle that, of course, is still probably the most important part. There are just so many ways that Tito can impact this roster and impact this franchise that I am so interested to see.
We're going to learn, is this core good enough? I think under David Bell, there was maybe some doubt as to whether he was the guy. Now, yes, there were a lot of injuries a year ago. With Francona, this is the litmus test. Like, if you can't win with him, then you can't win with the players.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We're going to find out if these players are good enough now that an experienced, accomplished person like Francona is at the helm. My key player, though, I think it's got to be. I'm going to let you go first. You go first.
Okay, so I want to talk about Candelario here. There are, again, with such a weird roster where it's like, where's this guy playing? Where is he going to be every day? Where is he going to be in the lineup? Is he going to be facing lefties? Is he going to be, you know, there are so many questions for so many of these guys. Candelario was, I believe he ranked 165 out of 169. Position players last year in F4. You can look at the counting stats and be like, oh, it was a January Candelario season. He had 20 homers, you know, had a bunch of RBIs. The dude was bad. He was bad on defense and he was a bad hitter. He is their highest paid position player. He is their most veteran position player. How he fits into this mix, because teams like the Reds generally can't literally afford to have someone that is their highest paid player not playing. And so how he fits in, whether he's DHing, whether he's playing third, where he obviously is not a good defender, whether he's at first, where he might be blocking a younger player who should be playing more often. He has to get back to being at least average. He cannot be a negative war player, which he was a year ago, especially for this lineup. Because yes, the ceiling is determined by McClain and De La Cruz, and Ellie is just, I've said it so many times on the show. I am so lucky that I was there for the beginning, and I can't wait to see what he does next. But Candelario was supposed to be a floor raiser, and he was bad. He was a detriment. And if he's going to be the highest paid player and the most senior kind of hitter on this team, he just has to be better.
I'm going to go with Ellie De La Cruz. He finished eighth in the MVP last year. He stole 67 bases, hit 25 home runs, and had an 809 OPS. That's a 119 OPS plus, right? Like, that's a good year, especially when you're offering all that value on the bases. And he was fine defensively, right? Like, he was fine. The ceiling here remains banana land. Like,
well,
Ellie De La Cruz is not close to the ceiling yet, no. Right? There is at least another level or two beyond what he's already shown us. He was worth 5.2 BWAR last year. This could be a 10-win seat. Like, he could be a 10-win player, right? And it's easier to be like, oh, all these other, like, he was good. He was their best player last year. So it's hard to say, man, he needs to be better for the Reds to be good. If he does the same exact thing as he did last year, like, it won't be his fault. if they don't make the playoffs, right? Mm-hmm. But boy, he could change it all. He could change this franchise.
Yeah. Well, to me, it's very simple. He led the league last year in caught stealings and strikeouts. If he can, right? I mean, the strikeout rate last year was at, what was it, like 31%, which he proved he could still be an above average hitter striking out 30% of the time. If that gets to 27%, and if he becomes a base runner where he's stealing at a more efficient clip, because last year, yes, he stole 67 bases, he was caught 16 times. I'll put it this way, it's very simple. He finished eighth last year. I'm taking the over on eighth this year.
Yeah.
Like, he's finishing higher than eighth this year, no matter how good the Reds are. That's what I believe. So whether that's first or second, who knows? But like, I think he is taking another leap. How much better he got from year one to year two alone should tell you how quickly this guy can improve. So yeah, he's the whole thing. He is another guy where you should appreciate him while you have him for a lot of reasons. Obviously, it's not as fickle as you have with a position with a pitcher, but it's the same kind of thing. You have to be making the most of having someone like this on your team.
Over under is 79.5.
Man, so I'm feeling pretty good about this team. I got to be honest. We didn't really touch on the pitching, but I think that they've assembled enough depth. I'm a little worried about the depth of the bullpen, but I'm a Tito believer, and I doubt I'm going to pick this team to make the postseason, but I think they are finally going over 500 here. So I think this is 83 or 84 wins, and I think I might be picking them to finish second. We'll see. But yeah, I'm going over 79.5.
I'm taking the over. I have decided every team in this division is winning 81 games. All right. Our next
totally
team.
Valid.
Our next team is the St. Louis Cardinals, who have a projected record of 79-83, 23% chance to make the playoffs, 14% to win the division. Sound familiar? Their line last year was 85.5. They won 83 games. Jordan took the over. Boo. Jake took the under. Yay. 83 wins, but boy, it was a soggy, lackluster, uninspiring 83 wins. A lot of those, I think, came down the stretch, right? Like, they were out of it pretty early, and it was just at no point did this smell like a playoff team. No. And then over the winter, they were the only team in the entire league to sign a single MLB free agent.
Yeah. To not sign a single free agent, I guess you should say. It's like zero. Yeah, yeah. They spent $0. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Nick Anderson on a minor league deal is like the only guy who's been in the big leagues that they signed. They spent 3 months talking about how they wanted to trade Nolan Arenado and then didn't. Some of that, whether that was their fault or Nolan Arenado's fault, it sounds like they had found a trade to send him to Houston, and Nolan said, no, 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 not so fast. And now he's still on the Cardinals, which is very strange in and of itself. But now, after the least busy offseason of any team in baseball, they have a team that still looks fine. Behind the dish, they got not Wilson Contreras because he's moving to first. Ivan Herrera, Pedro Pajes will kind of balance out behind the dish.
Time out here.
Yeah.
Pedro Pajes and Ivan Herrera. Mm-hmm. Sneaky, exciting tandem here. Herrera rakes.
Yes.
Now, how good is he defensively?
Yeah.
TBD. If you play fantasy baseball, Ivan Herrera is a great sleeper for someone who can catch and drop bombs.
Yeah.
I'm very in on this guy.
And Pajes is the opposite. He's a fantastic defender. It is a really cool combination. And having those guys, and they got more catching prospects coming, by the way, had Wilson Contreras, who was awesome offensively when he played last year. He was like, you know what? That's fine. I'll move to first. I'll stick around here. I want to be in the lineup every day. He was fine with it. And so now he's their first baseman, which will probably be an upgrade over whatever was left of Paul Goldschmidt last year. So this is probably a spot where they will improve.
And now the Nolans. Nolan Gorman at second base, who looked like a future cornerstone piece, was totally
really
horrible
bad. Really bad
in 2024. Yeah. Nolan Arenado was sufficient. He's a future Hall of Famer on the downslope of his career, and that's fine. Does he finish the year here? Who the hell knows? Shortstop Mason Winn, just an amazing year. I believe he was a 5-win player for the Cardinals.
Yep.
He's still only 23 and will be a part of this team for a long time. The outfield is Brendan Donovan, one of the best Swiss Army knives in baseball. Center is Lars Nootbaar. And right is Jordan Walker, who, you know, we'll get to him. DH Alec Burleson, who rakes sneaky. And then the rotation, no one really throws above 93 miles an hour. Sonny Gray, who, boy, I want him to get traded for his own sake so he can pitch in competitive games. Eric Fetty, who I feel the same about. Miles Michaelis, Andre Pallante, and Steven Matz. The bullpen, Ryan Helsley, who throws, I think, harder than all those other guys combined. Matthew Liberatore and Jojo Romero. One big question for you, Jordan Schusterman, about this team. What does a successful season look like for the Cardinals, who are clearly not actually trying to win the World Series?
Yes, that is how they have acted and spoke. However, the roster, again, we had the same question for the Marlins. We know, okay, what does success look like for a team that's probably going to be one of the two worst in baseball? I don't really see a path to the Cardinals being one of the worst teams in baseball. However, again, for those unfamiliar with the big picture here, this is a franchise that is being ready to turn over the reins to Chaim Bloom, who has now been a part of this front office in sort of an advisory role over the last year and a half, I want to say, and is now getting ready to kind of take over as president of baseball operations after this year. John Mozeliak, who has been in charge for a very long time, is kind of moving aside. Now,
as a whole,
yes,
the reputation of this organization, particularly from a player development perspective, is that they are way behind the curve. They are behind the times, and the structure of this needs to be updated
and
dramatically.
And that has begun already. So this is also at the minor league level and the coaching staff, also at the major league level, they have brought in a lot of new voices to kind of modernize. And it's so interesting because we talk about this with franchises who suck for a long time. We're like, oh my God, these guys are playing, you know, they're so in the past, whether it's the White Sox, whether it's the Nationals, whether it's the Rockies or Marlins, all these. But because the Cardinals were so good and so consistent for so long, nobody questioned how it was working. It was like, all right, well, whatever they're doing, it's working. They're churning out Brendan Donovan. They're doing XYZ. And then suddenly, you looked up and you were like, wait a minute, something is off, because now we do not have a roster that is competing and we do not really have the leadership or the path forward and the development status recently to where we can actually, clearly something ran out. Clearly the magic ran out. They needed to update things. And so that process is underway.
But unlike the Marlins, they have not turned the roster over. They have not ripped it up from the studs. They have not traded players away from prospects. Now, I think part of that is so that they can see what they have. Yeah. I think Chaim Bloom may do that next year, depending on how players perform this season.
They may do it this year still.
But I do think in the final year of John Mozeliak, who's been there for so long and has contributed to a lot of success during this Cardinals tenure, I'm curious if they have any emotional cling to the players if they are kind of in the mix in the middle of the season. And so for me, here's what a successful season looks like. Clarity.
Yep.
I either want this team to know that they're bad or good early, because if they're in the middle, that's how it gets ugly.
Well, and it's just an interesting thing to wonder if they were able to trade Nolan Arenado in December, if Sonny Gray and Wilson Contreras, who have no trade clauses, said, yes, I do want to leave, which they didn't do. They probably do trade all those guys and they probably trade Helsley too, right? Like there was a version of the offseason where they did strip it down and it was an entirely young roster and it was like a more traditional reset year. Right now, I just think they have too many good players to be totally out of the mix, but I think they're more likely to just end up they'll be like, you know, 5 or 6 games out come the deadline and they say, sure, we're technically still in it, but we have to do what's right for the organization, and they trade those guys away. Because Helsley in particular, I mean, these other guys are a little bit more complicated because they're owed more money and they have longer contracts. Helsley's one of the best relievers in baseball, and he has 1 year left on his deal. Like, this is a guy for a team that does not intend to win a championship that you should be trading for a haul. They've obviously decided that they think they can get more for him at the deadline than they can right now. Maybe that's true. Maybe it's not. But he's certainly the biggest one. He's another one that could be an absolute game changer that could be moved at some point this season. But right now, I just think, again, as we move to our key players, like, there's a lot of players that you could choose from, because the younger guys, getting the mulligan from Walker and Gorman in particular. Jordan Walker felt like he was my key player a year ago, and he's probably my pick still now. This dude's still, he's younger than Dylan Cruz, right? Giving up on this guy does not make any sense at this point. How they handled him, where just throwing him into the outfield and hoping for the best without it was, they have not handled Jordan Walker well. He has obviously not responded particularly favorably in certain cases. He has not performed in ways that you would expect for someone who is that productive as a rookie, but the talent is still in there. Even if he's not going to be a great right fielder, this is still a bat I think they want to and believe they can build around, but he has to start showing that again. And then Gorman, who's more of a volatile player because of the strikeouts, both of those guys, they have to find, when we talk about finding out what they have, Gorman and Walker are at the top of that list, because I think they know what Nupar is. I think they know what Donovan is. I think Wynn, of course, was a huge breakout. Those are good players, but these are the two that could swing a lot, and we need to know if they're definitely part of the next good Cardinals team.
I'm fascinated because the hitters are relatively young, and a lot of it is Jordan Walker good? Is Nolan Gorman good? Can Alec Burleson do that again? Can Mason Wynn continue to improve? Where on the pitching side, I mean, there's a lot of old dudes.
Yes.
They're kind of set, right? It's like Sonny Gray, Eric Fetty, Miles Michaelis are all 32 and over. Steven Matz is 33. So for me, my key player, I'm going to kind of go off the board here, and I'm going to take Michael McGreevy.
Yeah. I mean, this is a category of pitcher that I think is very important.
So McGreevy had 3 starts in the big leagues last year for the Cardinals and was really good. He is probably going to start the year in AAA, though he's in the mix for a rotation spot. He's 24, turning 25 soon. They need to prove that they can develop a pitcher. That has been, in my opinion, a bigger issue for them than on the hitting side, where they've continued to churn out Wynn, Donovan, et cetera.
Yeah.
The arms have just been so blah. So this group of like McGreevy, Matthew Liberatore, Tink Hentz, eventually Quinn Matthews, having any of those players show that they can be on the next great Cardinals rotation for a long time, I think that's a very important part
100%
of their season.
That's I'm so with you, just because we do not know what this, because of the contracts, because of the age of these other pitchers, the 2026, let alone 2027 rotation is very difficult to visualize right now.
Yeah.
I hope that a year from now, a couple of those arms, whether it's Matthews after his amazing season last year, whether it is McGreevy, Tekoa, Roby, like they have guys in the upper minors, but they have to prove that they can become those next arms. So I think that's a great pick.
Over under.
Ooh.
76.5.
Here we are again. 76.5. So this would reflect, this is not a team that wants to be good. To me, they will be on pace to win more than 76.5 games. And it's just about how dramatically they veer towards the under in the second half because of the deals that they make. I think I'll still say over slightly. But I recognize that they could pivot pretty hard and be pretty bad if especially if those pitchers are not showing up in the second half. Like the pitching staff, once they trade some, if and when they trade some of these guys, could be pretty bad. So that would be the express lane to a 72 win season.
I'll take the under. I think they will trade away at the deadline, and that will sink them in the second half.
Yep.
So I will go with the under. I do think this club will finish fifth. I'm actually headed over there in about 20 minutes. So
all right.
I will tell you, I will know more after that, which is useless for the listeners. Let's take a break. And when we get back, we'll do the Brewers and the Cubs.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Before we get to the Brewers and the Cubs, allow me to remind you that fantasy baseball season is here. We cannot encourage you enough to do it with Yahoo. Yahoo Fantasy Baseball. It is time to start that long journey towards that coveted 2025 Fantasy Baseball Trophy. Join a league with your crew. Start preparing for your draft. Opening day is coming up. If you don't have a league to play in, got plenty of public leagues. You can start drafting instantly today. Sign up in the Yahoo Fantasy app or head to yahoo.com/fantasy baseball. Jake Mintz, it's time to talk about the division champs, the Milwaukee Brewers. No, they are not projected to defend their title, as Fangraphs has them at an even 81-81, 34% chance to make the playoffs, 22% chance to win the division. What happened last year? Craig Council left and they traded Corbin Burns and everyone was like, don't worry about the Brewers. They're not relevant. And then the rest of the division was so mid and Pat Murphy was like, Let Me Cook. And the Brewers won 93 games and they won the division. And then they had their heart ripped out by the New York Mets. Remember the feeling, those back-to-back home runs, Jake Bowers, Sal Frelick, oh, the Brewers are going to beat the Mets. And then Pete Alonso said, not so fast. Since the Brewers were in the 2018 NLCS, that seven-game clash with the Dodgers, one of the better postseason series we've had over the last 10 years or so, the Brewers are 2-10 in October. Ouch. So they've been in October plenty. Postseason six out of the last 7 years, but they have not been able to really make that deep run. But their line last year was 76.5. Jake, you said under. You were like, this team's going to stink, but you weren't the only one. I said over, but I was like, they're not making the playoffs. They won way more than 76.5. Let's talk about the 2025 team. Once again, they were like, oh, you know, those players you've gotten used to and you really like them, they're not on the Brewers anymore. They traded Devin Williams to the Yankees. Willie Adames left in free agency. It's not surprising anymore when these things happen and the Brewers are willing to let guys go. They bring in Jose Quintana. They trade for Nestor. Those are two new lefties on in the rotation. Mark Canna is back in sort of a bench role. Caleb Durbin, one of our favorites, will be making his major league debut for the Brewers at some point early in 2025. There's still again, a lot of the team players that won this division last year are still around, but there are certainly some questions. So who's on the Brewers, Jake?
Well, I think we should also just mention when we talk about the offseason, obviously the passing of Bob Uecker, who is the single most impactful and important person in the history of the Brewers franchise, who has been around this team for decades, will not be around anymore this year. And I think that that will cast a melancholy, nostalgic shadow. A lot of the season will be about celebrating Bob Uecker's life, certainly a person who would not have wanted his passing to be gloomy, for that is not how he moved through this world. And so I don't want to say I'm excited to see how they honor him, because death is not something that is necessarily exciting, but I am interested and compelled by that on how they, you know, kind of continue the memory and the legacy of Bob Uecker.
Yeah.
The players on this team, William Contreras, the best catcher in the world, I think,
certainly is a strong case.
Dish. First base, congrats on the homer, dude, Reese Hoskins. Reese, who has looked great in spring training this year. Last year was a little shaky for him coming off the ACL tear. He just wasn't totally himself. We're hopeful. We love Reese. You know that. Second base, the other infield alignment's a little wonky here. Bryce Terang at second, Joey Ortiz at short, and then some combo of Oliver Dunn, Caleb Durbin at third base. Now, if Caleb Durbin is going to make the team, he probably fits better at second, which could put Terang at short and Ortiz back to third. That all seems in flux. I think the first couple months of the season will be about the Brewers figuring out the optimal infield mix. The outfield, though, is a little less up in the air. Center field, Garrett Mitchell. Right field, Sal Frelick. Left field, Jackson Chourio, one of the best young players in the world. Full stop. Christian Yelich is going to spend a lot more time DHing than he has in previous seasons. The rotation, Freddie Peralta, Tobias Myers, who was just one of the most surprising breakouts of the 2024 season. Nestor Cortez, who they got in the Devin Williams trade. Aaron Civale and Jose Quintana. The bullpen, no Devin Williams anymore, but Trevor McGill is actually pretty good. And the Brewers are going to find relievers who get outs. This is kind of what they do. One big question: can they keep getting away with this? Can they really do this again?
I mean, again, it's 6 or 7 years of the postseason tells me yes. Tells me that the infrastructure in place is strong enough that, not that Craig Counsell is a bad manager, but I don't think they, you know, needed him in the same way. And Pat Murphy certainly brought a different energy that really matched a lot of the young players on this team. And you think about, okay, well, they lose Willie Adames. They trade an elite reliever in Devin Williams. So then how do they get better? Because one of the interesting parts of last season was that they didn't replace Corbin Burns. And by the end of the season, it was like, boy, could they use Corbin Burns. Now, Joey Ortiz was very good for them. We'll talk about him more in a second. But this is a season, too, where it's like, okay, well, then how are you going to backfill the guys that you are willingly letting go? Not that anyone expected them to re-sign Willie Adames, because we knew he was going to get super paid. At the same time, can you keep replenishing? Can you keep these young guys going and trending in a positive direction, and who's gonna be getting better. Because my God, was William Contreras good? And with catchers, like, as much as I believe in him, it's hard for me to imagine him having as good of a season just because that's just the nature of the position. But what do we get from Reese? Do we have some of these younger guys? And then Churio, right? Churio is the one who's ascendant. He just turned 21 earlier this week. He is the youngest player in baseball, at least until, I guess, Roman Anthony makes his debut. But he's amazing. And he's the one, too, as we kind of talked about with Ellie, not quite as supersonic, but still a similarly incredible talent that could, you know, be competing certainly for All-Star games, maybe MVPs one day. So that is a big question, though, is can they keep doing this? Can they keep turning it over and letting familiar faces go and keep staying competitive?
I'll give you the answer to that after the over-under. My key player is going to be Reese Hoskins, just because he is a power guy and they don't have a lot of that in this lineup. Even William Contreras, who was sensational a season ago, only hit 23 home runs. Reese, I believe, hit 25, but he can hit 35,
yeah.
You know, and that's a big difference. Duh, it's 10. He's just a big key, because having that big bopper in the middle of the lineup just kind of solidifies so much and makes it more exhausting for pitchers. And then the other one is really, it is Jackson Churio, because he could be a top five MVP guy. The skill is there. He was in the second half of the season, once he kind of figured some things out. He's not as exhilarating as Ellie or Bobby Witt. His value is a little less obvious. Like, you don't go to a game and say, oh, Jackson Churio is obviously the best player if you knew nothing about baseball, right? In the way that Ellie is, in the way that Bobby Witt
is. But then you
would
look up on the scoreboard and be like, sorry, he was born when?
He was born when?
it's like, wait, what? This guy batting third was born in 2004? So, but no, I agree with you. It's not as physically eye popping. Sure. Sorry, I thought you were. I was kicking it back to you. Give me 1 second.
I had nothing else to say.
Okay, that's fine. All right, Carter, I'll pick it up in a second here. 1 second. 3, 2, 1. So yeah, I think Churio 100%. Although I am still, because I believe in him and I think he'll keep trending up, I'm focused on those infielders you mentioned before. Joey Ortiz, Bryce Terang. Terang, Platinum Glove winner. We know what we're getting defensively. Joey Ortiz was also awesome defensively, but he was also awesome offensively for the first 2 months. Really fell off in the second half. Willy Adames, even if they knew he was going to leave because they weren't going to give him $180 million, not only was he a huge deal, you know, on the field where he was a shortstop with 32 home runs and 112 runs driven in. Like, that's a lot of production that you are now trying to replace with younger, less experienced players. Also a massive deal off the field. Not that they don't still have a lot of leadership in there, but we know how much of a connector that Willie is. And he's also part of why the Giants were so excited to get him. And so, not that I think this clubhouse is going to fall apart, but I just know how important Willy Adames is to a clubhouse. As cliche as that sounds, like, that he is one of the guys where I will happily say that with a straight face and believe that it is important. So I think Ortiz and Terang are really interesting no matter where they're positionally fit in. And then the other guy I have to mention, that I don't even think we've said his name yet, is Brandon Woodruff. Coming back from shoulder surgery, having missed the whole year a year ago, you know, we have Yelich coming back from back surgery, and that's important too. But I mean, Brandon Woodruff was one of the best pitchers in baseball before he went down. But shoulder surgery is scary, and it's not as much of a, like, oh yeah, he'll be back, we'll just be patient and he'll be back, the kind of way we talk about with elbow surgery. So I think he just actually threw to hitters earlier this week for the first time, so I don't expect to see him that early in the season. But Brandon Woodruff that's the kind of guy that even 90% of what he was before is changing the complexion of this rotation and makes me believe more that if they do get back into the postseason, I'm excited to give the ball to Brandon Woodruff. And they don't have that many other guys on this rotation right now that I really feel that way about.
Over under 84.5.
I think this is the hardest one for me of all of them, to be honest. Man. I think I'm going to go over slightly, but I'm feeling, again, I before we started recording, I compared it more to 2022 when they won 86 games, and that's the last time they missed the postseason, but it was still 86 wins. I think it's going to be something closer to that. I just think that the division is going to be better enough to where it's not as clear of a path to 90 wins. And while I don't think that they're going to bottom out, I just think that there's going to be enough steps back that I think they're going to be just on the outside looking in. So I'll say 85. I'll go slightly over with the 85.
I'm done doubting this operation. I was very low on them last year. I looked stupid. and I'm saying over, and I think they're going to win the division. Here's the deal. There are really three teams that operate like this, where if a player gets close to free agency, they're gone. It's and have success, right? It's Cleveland, it's Tampa, and it's these guys. The difference is these guys in Cleveland have a cornerstone franchise icon in the middle of it with Jose Ramirez and Christian Yelich. And the other difference between this group and Cleveland is there is a paradigm-shifting young dynamo coming up from the bottom, and that is Jackson Chourio. And I think that that is a separator. I have so much belief in the rest of this organization to conjure outs and discover runs that the rest will just – that will just fall into place. Yeah. I don't think they can win a World Series because the high-end pitching just isn't there that can get them deep into the postseason. But they are going to – they just do this. Yeah. They just do this. They just keep getting away with this. And I'm now where I am with the Brewers is where like I was with the Astros 3 years ago, where it's like I'm just going to – I'd rather look stupid believing in them than look stupid – not believing in them.
And a lot of us look real stupid last year.
I'll take the over, and I'll pick the Brewers.
All right, there you go. All right, well, that is also a hedge against this final team, the Cubs of Chicago, who are projected by Fangraphs to win 84 games. But they are, that is the most in this division. 54% chance to make the playoffs, 41% chance to win the division. Worth noting that Pecota, the projection system over at Baseball Prospectus, loves the Cubs. And has them as one of the best teams in baseball and has them running away with this division. Fangraphs not quite as enthusiastic. Last year, the Cubs over-under was 84.5. We both took the over. And they won 83. Now, remember that after the deadline, they went like just got crazy hot. And it was like, oh, man, okay, sure, Cubs. All right, we're doing this. Let's go. And then they were two games behind the Mets on September 1st. Like they were in that mix. And then it just September was not pretty. And then by the end, it was another disappointing season on the North side. This team has not won a playoff game since 2017. And it's time to go. It's time to go. And that was reflected in the urgency expressed this winter when they salary dumped Cody Bellinger. They traded a decent haul, Isak Paredes, who they just acquired last deadline, and their first round pick, Cam Smith. They trade him to Houston for Kyle Tucker. 1 year of Kyle Tucker. They also get Ryan Pressly from the Astros. They trade for Ryan Brazier, another veteran reliever. They sign some other veterans, John Birdie, Carson Kelly, Justin Turner, Gage Workman. What a Rule 5 pick that's looking to be. Love that guy. There was urgency in the Kyle Tucker trade. They didn't spend that much money, right? We kind of compared them and the Red Sox as being in a similar situation as like, all right, guys, come on. You're the Red Sox. You're the Cubs. It's time to win. It's time to spend. The Red Sox finally did that, first with the Crochet trade and then signing Bregman. The Cubs did the ballsiest trade in trading for Kyle Tucker for 1 year of Kyle Tucker. But did they actually do enough to put this team back in the postseason, put this team back in the division? Who is on the Chicago Cubs, Jake?
Behind the dish, Miguel Amaya and Carson Kelly, a tandem that I frankly don't think is good enough. Amaya has just kind of been on the fringes of having the number one job for a long time now and just hasn't taken the reins. And I think Carson Kelly is like a solid number two. I don't know how you upgrade here, but this is just an area where I have a little bit of concern. First base, Michael Busch. And some Justin Turner from time to time. Nico Horner will be at second. He is hurt. Third base is going to be a Matt Shaw, Gage Workman tandem, which is hilarious. I think by the end of the year, it'll be mostly Shaw. I'm not as much of a believer in Workman as you are, and I will take the prospect pedigree of Shaw, shortstop, Dansby Swanson, outfield, Ian Happ in left, PCA in center, Kyle Tucker in right, and Seiya Suzuki at DH. That's just a fun quartet of players. Starting rotation, Shota Imanaga, Justin Steele, Jameson Taillon, Matthew Boyd, and Colin Ray, with the greatest pitcher on the planet, Javier Assad, on the IL. Bullpen, Ryan Pressly, and just a hodgepodge of dudes who, frankly, just weren't that good.
A Porter hodgepodge, to be clear. That's what that is.
No, I know.
But Porter Hodge is good. I like him. I like him more than Ryan Pressly, actually.
A Porter hodgepodge.
Anyway, big question for the Cubs. For me, how good do they have to be for Jed Hoyer's red hot seat to cool off? He is in the final year of his contract. Pobo,
I would say
Mr.
That
Jed Hoyer.
Jed Hoyer is the Pobro.
he has Pobro energy. That's true. Yeah. I agree with that. Where is the line? Is there a version of the Cubs of this Cubs season that does not involve a postseason appearance where Jed Hoyer gets to continue in 2026? Is this a team that is now good enough that we are excited to project them to win the division? I think it is for me, but we can get to that at the end. But that to me is a question. Is like, is it as dire in a sense as I think it is being presented narratively?
Yes.
Yeah.
They have not made the playoffs since 2020. They have not won a playoff game since 2017.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is the Chicago Cubs, people.
Yeah.
All right. I know you fans went 7,000 eons and without a World Series title, but like a different era. What are we doing here? And I think if Jed Hoyer he became the big boy, I believe, in 2020, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like you've had six seasons. If you can't do it in six seasons with the resources, now yes, they should be spending more than they are, but it's still a lot. Like they still have resources. This is still the Chicago Cubs, right? If you can't do it now, I agree. It is time to maybe make that change. I think he has to make the playoffs or else you change the leadership here.
Yeah. Well, I'm also just compelled by that because of Council's role in that, right? I mean, how disappointing his first year as this historic, shocking, one of the more shocking managerial sequences we've ever seen, him leaving Milwaukee, getting this record deal in Chicago that I guess has since been usurped by Dave Roberts. Congrats to Dave Roberts on the extension. But this is I don't think anybody blamed Craig Council last year, but you were also hoping that he would help them get over the top last year. And whether it was his fault or not, it didn't happen for whatever reason. Let's get to the key players. I'm going to go first and just do the obvious. I don't need to overthink this one. Kyle Tucker is one of the most important players in the 2025 season across the board. This is a player who has been almost hiding in plain sight in Houston as one of the best players in baseball, behind a bunch of other really awesome players who are way more famous. But what he did last year in part-time because he was injured was unbelievable. And I think that when we talk about Kyle Tucker, it's not just that he had been very good for, you know, the 3 or 4 years prior. It's that last year, it took another step up. It took a step up to where the OPS was closer to 1,000 than 900. And he was walking more than ever. And he's still an impact base runner, an impact fielder. This is the kind of game-changing offensive talent that the Cubs have been looking for. But it's 1 year. We'll be talking about him in the context of, oh my God, if he is dominating, if he's playing like he did last year, we're going to be talking about, like, oh my, is this guy going to get $400 million this year? Is it like we're going to be talking about that? It's just for him individually, regardless of how it fits in the Cubs. But when you talk about how aggressive of a deal and how potentially bad of a long-term baseball trading Cam Smith and Isak Paredes was for 1 year of Kyle Tucker, we love that aggressiveness, and we are glad that more teams are willing to act like that. And I think that the situation dictated a move like that, but that is going to be a franchise-changing decision for better or for worse. Kyle Tucker could help them win the division, and if he doesn't, whether that's his fault or not, we will be having a lot of big conversations about that trade for a long time, because Cam Smith, who now looks like he's going to be in the big leagues already for good parts of the season, and Paredes also might be awesome for Houston, right? Like, he's another interesting part of that deal that they acquired and then immediately flipped. So he is just so important for so many reasons, for him as an individual going into free agency, and of course, as one of the best players in baseball, that the Cubs desperately need to play like that if they want to get back into the postseason.
I will go with Pete Crow Armstrong, who you wrote about this week. PCA, as he is delightfully known, the speedy center fielder. This is a singular character of a human being. He is a Gen Z Energizer bunny. PCA can do things on a ball field that other people can't do. And that is because his speed is a game-changing asset. It helps him in center field, and it helps him on the bases. and it raises the overall floor of his value. He does not need to be even an average hitter to be a helpful player. But if he can be better than that, if he can have a 115 OPS plus, it's an all-star because those secondary attributes are so game-changing. And I am fascinated to see, he's now 23. This is his third taste, his first opportunity to be the starting everyday center fielder. They traded away Cody Bellinger in part because they believe that PCA can be that guy. If you are looking into the future, even 1 year, once Kyle Tucker presumably leaves in free agency, PCA, I think, will be the best player on the 2026 Cubs. That journey starts now, right? That journey starts now. He is a highlight machine. How good is he of a hitter? We're going to learn.
We are going to find out because he was swinging at everything last season. He was striking out a lot. He wasn't drawing a lot of walks. But every secondary skill that you can want, elite speed, an elite arm in center field, which adds to the fun of his defensive profile. So I'm sure he could steal more bases. He was very efficient. He was only caught three times, stole 27 bases. And yeah, he was a top 20 player in baseball over the last, I think, 2 months by F4. He can do that. And that was with like a 120 WRC plus. So that's really interesting that you say that, right? He could be their best overall player a year from now. That's what that says about, say, Suzuki and Ian Happ and Dansby Swanson. Like, that's a different debate. But there is a path there that I agree with.
If he was a 2.5 win player over a full season with a 88 OPS plus.
Yeah.
If that gets to 105, it's almost a player.
He was a 2.5 win player by F4 over the last 2 months, right? Once he was hitting. So he's so much fun and also just an awesome personality and just so honest and so engaging and so thoughtful. And I'm excited to root for that guy. And check it out. I obviously wrote a lot about Pete, so you can go check that piece out on Yahoo Sports. But those are our key players. There's a lot of interesting players on this team for sure. The over-under is 87.5. I'm taking the over. I think they're going to win the division. I think they are going to break through. I think they have done enough. I think that this, I think it's going to happen. I don't know how far they can make it. I still have some questions in the bullpen and kind of the back of this rotation. But the other thing about this team is they have a lot. All their top prospects are in AAA. So there's versions where some of those guys can come up and help as well. And if Shaw is immediately good, like we're big Matt Shaw believers, that's another difference maker on this offense that already had some pretty good pieces and I think could be well above average this year with some steps forward and then with the addition of Tucker. So I'm in. I'm drinking the Kool-Aid. I think they're going to win about 89, 90 games. I think they're going to win the division. Maybe it's a basic take and they'll disappoint again, but I'm in. I think the Cubs are going to do it.
I'll take the over and pencil them in as a wild card club.
Okay.
I think the depth is much better than it's been in previous seasons to handle injuries when they come. I like the arms they have ready to bring up. Jordan Wicks, Ben Brown, Cody Poteet, Cade Horton.
Yep.
That compels me. I think this bullpen simply just has to be better. It can't be that bad again. It won't be that bad again. I still think the ceiling from an offensive perspective just isn't really that high. There's a lot of guys I like and not a lot of guys I love. Still, I think there's a playoff appearance here for the Cubs.
This is a good place to end. Last year, the NL Central's second place teams, which was the Cardinals and Cubs, had the fewest wins of any second place teams. I bring that up to say, you mentioned the Cubs as a wild card team. In this National League, and this is going to become more relevant when we preview the NL West on Friday, is there room for a second NL Central team in this postseason race? That is what is really compelling here. I don't think so. I'm
going to pick
five
wildcard teams.
There you go. You'll just say, screw the rules. Let them all in like it's 2020. I don't think so. I think the Cubs are going to get in, and I think that the Reds and the Brewers are going to be pretty okay, but not good enough to be better than some of those NL West and NL East teams. but maybe you're right. Maybe that there is enough room for both the Brewers and the Cubs in the way that we obviously did not think there was room for the Tigers and the Royals last year. So would it be that shocking? It's baseball. But that is, I think, a good place to kind of finish off there with our NL Central preview. We did it. We previewed another division. Four more to go. NL West on Friday. I'm going to New York next week to hang out with you and wake up at 6 a.m. and watch the Tokyo series featuring those Chicago Cubs and the Los Angeles Dodgers, who we will talk about on Friday. Thank you to Carter Singh for producing this episode. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. Thank you to those who sent life advice for me turning 30. I really appreciate it. Ooh. And we will talk to you all on Friday. Thanks for listening.